client gave a preview here that of a task that pretty much is impossible to completely do because there's no way I'm going to cover one study every 40 seconds. And I think my task count of 54, I got something like 65. It depends on how far you go and what you include, and if you're including things like mature waste and dose reduction and easy results and all those sorts of things. There's a lot here to cover. I'm just going to hit the highlights, really, of some of the historic things of the MARC data. I want to let you know where we're going in terms of cow efficiency a lot. Some of the things we've looked at as a result of the new GPE continuous evaluation program and where we're at with cow mature waste right now, and then where we're going in terms of measurement of cow efficiency. So that's kind of the skeleton of the program. I'll probably get back here to go. Mike talked about this already, and this is, I mean, how much of a debate would we just have here for 10 minutes after we talked about what the right thing is here? And I don't think any of us can say this very well right now. Most of the measures we have right now that people talk about efficiency and they want a one-stop solution, we're talking about population measures in general. And everybody loves things like cow meat or cow exposed or total weaning weight, or sellable weight, whatever that sellable weight would be for some unit of energy and all those sorts of things. All of these things that we talk about in terms of the whole population, that this is our herd. And when we're talking here in the Meat Improvement Federation right now, we're not talking about population to make these changes directly. We have to make changes on individual fire bases. And what are the things that we see in the cows consistently? It gets this whole network that Mike showed that we need to be looking at a lot of different traits all together and trying to figure out how they fit together and get something here. These are just a small list of components, brainstorming, you know, of things that affect this right now. The path diagram is very extensive here. These are things I think of as more direct. I'd argue longevity is still a cost. And in some ways, and you can always think of that way, but you're still feeding that cow the longer they go, but it's also an advantage because you're avoiding them for development costs. Depends on how you look at it, and in long term, that gives you something here. Most of these, I can assign something that's a real cost benefit to. There's a ton of indicator traits that go into this that we measure in addition. One of the main things I'll be talking about tremendous amount here later is mature weight and where we've gone with that in the last. Last year, okay. So as I kind of already outlined this before, where we're going and what I want to talk about with this talk, I'll review some of the MARC research results. It's not going to be enough, I guarantee, as to what's been done there. And I've got some big leaders in the room with me here, with Dr. Larry Sundet, Harvey Streetley, back against the wall. So if I miss something, they're going to correct me. Current results with adult weight in the germplasm evaluation program, I'll spend just a little bit of time on that, and then future plans relative to the germplasm evaluation and cow intake overall. So, efficiency studies. When I look at this, and we summarize these 50-some journal articles, it's pretty impossible to really look at our efficiency work since the Meow Research Center has been in existence and not mention Ferrell. Basically, they are the drivers of a lot of this research that went on that we're famous for cow efficiency at the Meow Research Center. And really a lot of it went into, from the breed perspective for me and for this audience, to be evaluating energy utilization in various systems and across variable breed types, and really gets to some of the things where we said that it's desirable to know what the G by E interactions are, what is the environmental interactions are, and what kind of cattle biological types really fit into these different environments that we're curious about. Optimal efficiency depends a lot on breed types. I think that's one that we raised here at the end of the last talk right now. And a lot of the research that came out of the germplasm evaluation program was trying to show the biological type that cattle fit into so that people can make good economic decisions. And a lot of this research used the germplasm evaluation or germplasm utilization programs overall. This is a summary slide. I got this from a symposium talk, I think, in 1985 on ASAS that Dr. Farrell presented. Research work that's going on, and what I really want to take home out of this, actually, I think Dr. Sunday showed this last night, is how large of an impact the overall maintenance costs have and on the driver of the amount of energy being used by cows up to 455 days a day. And you see that right here. You'll see, I think there's a statistic that's often quoted right now, 65 to 75% of the cost associated with maintaining the cow herd and maintenance. It's pretty easy to see that in red right here. We do have this variation from breed to breed right here, Angus Hereford and Charlie Jersey crosses, I think, right at the bottom here, or you'll see that a lot of the breed variation is in that red bar right here. Okay, I think this is an important take-home message from this right now, and something we have to think about in terms of the cow maintenance. A lot of the research that really progressed after this went into things that such as visceral waste of different organs and things like that. I don't really cover that very much here right now, but there was work that came out of this talking about how important, say, liver size and heart size and kidneys, I believe, were in terms of the amount of maintenance energy being required by different animals. It's a cautionary tale as well. I think that's very true, and we need to be selective of those things. We also have to look at if we go too far the other way with some of these indicator traits and have too small a liver or too small a heart or things like that, what are we losing as a result? So there's a whole optimization sort of pattern that needs to be done when we're trying to think about these maintenance energy requirements. There's probably improvements that could be made. It's a variation, all variation that we want, and we'll change our calories. This is a fairly famous diagram, I think, and it's one of the most important take-home results of a lot of this efficiency work right now. This is from a 1994 paper summarizing data that was taken from, I believe, 1988 through 1991 or something like that. Basically, this was a study where the cows of these different biological breeds right here, this came from the germplasm utilization program, were selected to be fed at different levels of energy requirements, and those range from four different basically types of dry matter intake. I should remember right where those are on that chart. The point is, you can make a curve out of the results of that based on the efficiency of the animal, the amount of grams of sellable weaning waste, calf weaning, as a result of the dry matter intake and cow exposure. Okay? And what we see out of this right here, and what I want you to pay attention to, is not so much the breed differences change over time, and not the same cow as they were then. And just because of the amount of data that went into this, the power of individual gene breed differences aren't as strong as what the overall biological types here are right now. And the important thing is that we have different types of cows that are much more efficient when we have limited energy input than we do when we have much more excessive energy input. We need to think about this at different types and different systems across the United States right now. And what is our limiting energy requirement? Okay, this is more something that where the cows are being fed this diet for an extended period of time. We have to think in terms of cow-calf production, when is our real feed cost happening? For most of it, it's not in May and June. It's not when the grass is coming up and we've got plenty of forage. For most of us, it's trying to fill out winter rain, things like that. Where is the cost associated with this, with trying to fill out the cow efficiency, and which cost should we be assigning when we're trying to think about these indices overall? Okay? Maybe the other important thing about this coming from that same paper, a lot of those efficiency differences are in a phrase that we often don't pick up very well in terms of our region, but have a huge impact on overall business. One of the main drivers of this was facility. And very small differences in whether all the calves were weaned out of those calves every year or not, and even just in whether they had a calf or not, really impacted where these lines ended up. Okay? Red Bull, for instance, basically kept all but one calf, I think, through this whole project, and without a calf, a very, very small body condition score, and very small feed intake, ended up with some of the highest efficiencies in that low production environment. Okay. Other things that have come out of this, out of the Meow Research Center, there were regular evaluations of cow efficiency on a Medi-Cal basis based on prodigy gain per ME and going into the overall calf and dam system. These are expressed generally as percentages relative to sort of a mean level, overall mean value of the efficiency. And what you'll see here, I don't really want to dwell on these sorts of results, but they come out into the amount of weight gain, the amount of energy consumed by the progeny, and things like milk production, deposition, cow weight overall, and the amount of energy being consumed, whether the cows are being fed an individual intake or being fed on a thin basis, in some cases on meat, and rank these animals based on that, rank the breed types in terms of efficiencies at the bottom. These are good ways to get about in the system that we had at the Meat Animal Research Center, which of these breed types were ending up with some of the efficiencies that we were targeting overall. Ronnie Green, I think we mentioned it earlier, was one of these people, Mike said, that was actually looking at these sorts of things, actually showed that Brahman was a highly efficient cross to have, and Larry talked about it last night, highly efficient cross to have, even up in the northern United States, up where we are in Clay Center, because of how well they did in terms of energy production and still producing a calf every year with decent amount of milk production. Overall, really what a lot of this is getting at is that, and what a lot of the research I think can be summarized here in terms of targeting, is how do we best fit our biological types of animals into the different types of environments that are available out there. This is a slide I stole lately from Larry, trying to summarize really what some of the targets were, and the way you read this is that these X's are kind of an optimal level of where you want production to be in these types of trait complexes relative to the availability of feed resources for both the cow and the calf. Okay? So for instance, if you have low feed resources for finishing the progeny and low feed resources for the cow herd, you probably don't want a very big animal overall. Fairly logical, right? Okay? If you have high feed resources for the progeny and low feed resources for the cow, you start to see some of the advantages we have, not in just in terms of crossbreeding, not just for heterosis, but for breed complementarity of trying to pick up some of the gain where we're able to make it in terms of the value of that progeny and calf. Okay. Overall, and I think the point of this whole exercise here that we're having in this session right now is to try to, I think it is very important to think about indices or some sort of tools that can be used in all these different types of production environments. And in order to really take full advantage of that, I don't know if indices completely are the right thing on their own, but being able to customize with some of our modeling work, the SI system that came out of the Meat Animal Research Center, that really hasn't been used very much in terms of development since then. We need some sort of decision support tool that people can put in. These are the inputs, these are the outputs we have on our system right now. Which bowl can I go out there and get that actually makes an improvement on my bottom line? Okay. Whether that's an indices customized to the production that we currently have, or whether that's a large amount of computer simulation that effectively is an index as well, we need to be providing those tools. And it's not flashy, it's not exciting, but we need to do something that, that just is working well out there. Okay? That's a soapbox thing. If we go into cow longevity, I think that's the other important component we've had a lot of here at the Meadow Research Center. This again, is Larry kind of had given me some of these results. And looking at the power of crossbreeding in terms of keeping cows in the herd for a long time. In general, when we look at germplasm evaluation data, Larry, correct me if I'm wrong, but usually we did not pick up significant differences by breed, sire, type, in just across the long. We saw some differences, and if we would do some sort of combined analysis, we might have picked something up. But generally, within a cycle, it just didn't happen. This is different from the crossbred versus the purebred cow. Okay? In general, as you see right here, we start with the same number of cows remaining at the beginning, and already then, at 3 years of age, you start to see a separation of just that just persists in here, and end up with cows that generally are, we have 17% more cows in the crossbred at year 12 than we do in the straight breed. This is a different way of illustrating that same data point. I didn't have time to fit it in here, but there's some really interesting correlative traits that actually lead to some of these longevity differences between having an extra year of life on average as a crossbred versus straight head. Larry showed you some data on things like looking at the incisors of the animals and the way they wear over time and how that can affect the ability of the animal to actually use the forage resources available to them. And strongly correlated with the same thing, the crossbred did it as having better teeth for a longer period of time. We can go into several other trait complexes where it's not an individual thing about the cow itself, it's because the cow has more overall fitness. Keep going. Okay. Again, all of this is about matching the potential to the resources that are available on your farm right now, and us being able to, as researchers and feedstock producers, trying to help you match that environment to our best ability. Okay. What tools we can do and what would come out of this from all of these talks, I think, is an important topic of discussion. Certainly, I want to get out here. Growth and selection for growth has changed our energy inputs into the equation overall right now. Selection on higher yearling weight being one of the primary growth traits that have been selected on. I don't want to disparage that we've done that. I think there were slides shown yesterday or talked about yesterday and this morning that if we hadn't produced as much growth as we've been producing over the past 40 years through a result of selection and through other measures, our cow productivity overall, we probably have beef being a niche edible product instead of something that a lot of people are able to afford. At the same time, we've got to think about what we're adding to our cost and our cow herd overall, and I'll show you some of the results coming up here right now. I don't have a lot of data from the current GPE on longevity, survival, fertility, because we've only been going at this for about 7 years, and we only have cows that are just now getting to 5 years old. So we don't have a lot, really, of data for that right now, but we do have some preliminary look at some of the adult rates of these cattle that I want to show you here today. So are we changing efficiency through selection for growth? Larry's shown this slide a lot. I've shown this slide a lot. It's a test slide out of cycle 7 results, and that's relative to the old cycle 1 and 2 data on these exotic breeds that came in and were being prepared for Herkimer and Angus, Simpaw, Gelbie, Charolais, and Lindemann. And you'll see back in the day, the female sired by Herford and Angus were all definitely smaller than the female sired by the other four continental breeds, with Charolais being the largest mature weight cow at that time. These are all adjusted to constant body, just a score of 5.5. What's happened over 40 years? All of that red and blue line is not just the bull. I want to preface that because our cow herd got a lot bigger over that amount of time, too. The base cows that we were mating to got a lot bigger over time, too. And we probably had something fairly small, actually, with what those were being bred to a cycle cycle one and two with the Fort Robinson cows primarily, but and had cows that were mated to that got a lot bigger over time because of use of industry germplasm as well. The point is, they're definitely bigger, and the British breeds are definitely much more comparable to the continental breeds now in terms of their mature weight. The preconceived notions that we had about the amount of feed that was required to service a cow and have that cow produce a calf every year changes for every breed, and they really do relate to each other. Okay? We wanted to look at that a little bit more. This is just our 90 sample of bulls. I'd say all these are fairly equal. Gelding's kind of smaller here. I can't remember a significant difference in value on this very off the top of my head, but Gelding's probably
significant. Yeah, that's the only one.
The rest are the same. Yeah. This, as I already mentioned, this is our pet across breed ETD slide that we show all the time with genetic trends adjusted for yearling weight. This is a lot of where we're seeing that weight come in, I'm sure of it. We've gone as a breed of sire effect. This is the cross breed ETD adjustment factors on breed of sire, not whole breed effect. So you got to actually double the differences between these lines if you're looking at the breed effect. Have gone, you know, basically a 100-pound swing almost in our yearling weight since the introduction of ETD. That's a success story, but it's also what does it cost us in terms of the inputs on the cow and the inputs even on feeding these calves. So I wanted to look at what the overall cow weights were over time and where we're getting at in UGP right now. As most of you are aware, we're sampling 16 different breeds, 18 different breeds, sorry, in that right now. 14 of those 18, really, we have enough data on right now to make a little bit of a judgment on. Mature weight is limited. We don't have very many 5-year-old calves right now. Really, our weights are really a proxy for that mature weight because they are highly correlated. So I'm looking at basically their palpation weight when they're 1.5, 2.5, and 3.5 years of age. The data is not precise yet. I don't want anybody to take a picture now and go send it and publish this just yet, but I want to show you where we think things are going right now. And these weights, again, are adjusted for constant body condition. So the column on the right is really the scientist's interpretation of these data right now. The column on the left is me adding a constant value of weight to this to get it on a scale. Basically, this is kind of an average weight that these period of time that have been added to the column on the right, so you can kind of see some perspective on that. But the important thing is, similar to that cycle 7 data, in general, the breeds have gotten bigger. We don't see the same thing with gelding being smaller at this year and a half to aging away like if we get on that cycle 7 day data. You might see that change as we go on in some of the other slides. What we really see is that we have a few of the breeds that probably haven't selected as hard for yearling weight that are still pretty small at this year and a half period of time. If we go to 2.5 years, we see some of the same thing. We're losing a little bit of data now the further I go into years just because we're slowly replenishing our herd and we just have fewer cows overall that are at each age point. And again, Bromby's very small. Most of the breeds are caught up, and we start to see some convergence toward where that Angus level is right now. If we go to 3.5, we have the least data. Basically, all the significant differences are just about gone, except for two breeds right now. And one is much smaller than the others. But I think the take-home message here is that the story is very similar. We're getting bigger. We're already generally over 1,200 pounds in our environment right now at the Research Center, and we're not done yet, probably, in terms of the mature weight. So chew on that for a little bit and think about it, but this is where we're at on the cost side of things. We have to balance this for where we are on our growth side. If we think about the chart I showed earlier about efficiency, this is probably a good thing in highly productive environments. This is probably something that hurt us where we have forage limitations. Okay. some reads are moderated, others are larger than a type of seven. There seems to be some real opportunities for breed complementarity in some cases here, but overall, a lot of the breeds have really converged to similar mature weights, and as I said earlier, these results are preliminary. We'd like to have a few more years. I want to close with some of our plans to really major things in terms of efficiency over the next few years, and I'll give a shout out a little bit to Ron Lewis, who I'll be mentioning here on some of the work that we're trying to do to address where we're going with seed intake, measuring that overall in these cows, because as was said this morning, this is something that's severely lacking overall in our data sets. We don't have enough cow intake data, but doing it exactly right is really a chore because most of us don't feed our cows in the dry water. In terms of the life cycle efficiency, we've generally been focusing a whole lot of our efficiency research lately on the steer in the picture on the right, but we have other facets of the production cycle, including growing heifers and producing cows that will produce our calves for the next generation. And there's a lot of potential antagonistic relationships between each of these sectors right now, where the genes that would actually be advantageous to the steers in terms of having a good appetite and continuing to try to eat a lot so they put on a lot of fat are probably not advantageous in terms of the cow herd. Okay? We need to be looking at all three of these segments, but it's difficult to measure on breeding animals in all these different cases. We've been focused a lot here in this organization and in our breed associations on steer feed efficiency for the past several years. And if you'll remember from the chart I showed earlier, a lot of the variation that we really have in terms of our cost of our production environment from that work by Cal and Tom Jenkins is really in the maintenance energy of the cow. All right? So we tend to like to think about the cost on the things that we get the seeds on. We have to think about the cost on the things that we're not measuring as well in terms of the cow. We need to determine the relationships then among all three of these different types of environments, these different types of production systems, to decide where we want to be going and whether we can be complementary in the things that we select in all three of these segments. Just quickly, this is our target structure right now. I mentioned that we have the PPP going on right now. I don't want to really dwell on this at all other than to say we want to be able to use crosses of all 18 of these breeds right now and potentially other breeds that could enter into this over time in order to look at results that tell us things about cost and receipts from the perspective of each of these breed types and the breed combinations that will result from this. Feed intake. In terms of the female, we've gotten a lot of steer data. In terms of the growing female, we've been sampling the new heifers out of the germplasm evaluation now at a rate of about 330 to 400 heifers per year since 2009. Our plan with Harvey Creasley right now, taking up the lead on this, is to make sure that we go ahead and evaluate these uncold animals, the ones that the state of the production system is 5-year-old cows starting. I think later this year or early next spring, Harvey, something to that effect. Probably have that a little long.
Fall.
Thanks. And we'll use tail and gauge to do that, get individual feed intake. We're trying to approximate a hay diet that we're hopeful really shows just something that's more like what they'd be eating on the pasture rather than something that's full of silage and high energy. Okay. And reflect the draft consumption that those animals might have. One thing that's unique about all of this that I mentioned to you just a minute ago is that we're looking at these things in terms of cows on dry line, and it's likely different in the behavior of the cow on pasture. There's no selection chance for the cow to pick out which word they'd like to eat. They just get what's in their bunk and they just spin it up. There's nothing in terms of a diet preference. You know, it likely varies from animal to animal. There might be some cow that likes sagebrush a whole lot. Okay, probably not many, but if there were, we need to find some. But anyway. believe we just need to think about that, that when we're feeding these animals like this, they don't get a chance to pick what they want to eat. Changing the time span eating, right? Basically, if you have a cow and all she's got to do is stand in her pen or go to her bunk and eat, what's she going to do, right? She's generally going to keep eating on an ad-lib basis, and we're going to keep feeding it to her because that's what we're measuring. Okay? I mean, that's generally the way it's going to work. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's probably correlated, but if she's out on pasture, she'd actually have to work a little bit harder for doing this, maybe having to rummage a little bit around the thing I'm also doing. And so what I'm really getting at here is there's a real need to validate and validate how similar these two dry lot and pasture production environments are, and if intake on these cows in the dry lot is really the same thing. One possible solution, and this is where Ron Lewis at the University of Nebraska comes in, is trying to use markers of intake on the pasture in order to get an idea of what kind of forage these animals are eating. He's been looking at waxy markers that kind of exist on the stem and on the leaves of the plant. And those waxy markers are really long carbon chains, hydrocarbons, and alkanes. There's a few other candidates besides in alkanes that could work for this. And they're basically odd number of carbon molecules, odd number of carbons, so like 29 carbons, 31 carbons, things like that. And then we dose the animals with the even number of carbon chains that are not in the plant material in order to get an idea from them eating those even number of carbon chains at the same time as they're eating the plant material of how quickly that's passing through the system and how much of it is there is relative to the amount of plant material that they eat. Okay? We can predict intake and differentiate plant material at all tests overall. We do have to dose these animals out on the pasture. So this is an example from some work from a graduate student of Ron's while they were still at Virginia Tech of trying to differentiate between red clover and fescue and some enalkanes and long chain alcohols, basically another type of long carbon chain at the same time. This is an idea that not only can we get an idea of the intake of the animal relative to the markers that we're feeding, we can differentiate between the type of material that they eat, so we can tell if they've been eaten by how much of the C29 comes back, where you'll notice that red clover is much higher than fescue, relative to how much of the C308 comes back, or the C31 where they flip, we can get an idea of whether they're eating more clover or fescue as a result of that. And I won't go into the mechanics of that, but the energy content of the leaves or the stems of each of those plant materials relative to each other is just, and so an animal that's actually eating a lot more red clover is probably getting a lot more protein, and if that animal prefers that, that's probably a different characteristic of their eating ability and their intake ability than an animal that's going more for the best. Okay, you'll notice, and the part of the reason why we need to do so many of these is that some of the markers are not very good for individual plants. But a combination of several of these waxy markers, we hope, helps us differentiate a large number of spores overall. Okay, and this is an idea, again, from Ron, that gives us an idea just on a few different animals of different types of things that those animals do. And you'll notice there is variation here. Okay, there are cattle that seem to prefer one type of input over. How do we dose? This is a Mickey machine that Ron designed. I don't know how much engineering work went into this necessarily, but it basically is tail and gate on wheels. You can feed six animals with this particular system at one time. They have key, they can eat one thing. And basically what you end up doing is they've got their own place where they get to try out a little bit of a sweet cake or something that they really like, and eat it once a day, and then go away and go eat their grass in that plant. Okay, right. The thing that we can do then with that is add color to that in terms of the dye, and try to get an idea then in the fecal sample based on the color of which animal's fecal material that is. by what they ate, and then basically using that, eating a little bit of color and a little bit of their overall sweet feed, detect the color in a fecal sample, and then use that sample to monitor what else is in the supplement, the even chain fatty, the even chain, even carbon fatty acid relative to the plant material in the fecal sample. So we identify the animal with the paint and with the dye, and then we use the rest of the supplement to identify how much that animal ate in terms of grass relative to the marker that's in the feed. Okay. Difficulty about this is we can't do too many at once. Okay? We'd love to have one of these materials that maybe let us do 200 cows on one pasture. It'd be pretty hard to differentiate 200 different cultures. Okay? My son doesn't have that many carry-on. So we'll see what we can do from there. Right now, as part of this plan, before we came out on a sabbatical with us a couple of years ago, we have characterized much of the grass composition on some of our pastures at the Indiana Research Center. As I said, we have a limited ability to make a large number of cows simultaneously. So the hope is we take some of the dry lot animals and the streams that we see in there and run them through this system to see if the phenotypic correlations of intake on the dry lot system, where we'll also look and try to do some of this leaf alkane stuff on the composition of the diet in that case. We'll try to see if that is highly correlated to the pasture intake. Okay. Pretty excited about this. We want to keep doing these things. Long term, you know, maybe we can use other measures as well. We talked about this a fair bit. Fecal sample without supplementation. One of our scientists is trying to figure out how we can identify from the animal's DNA that's in the fecal sample, if we can identify where it came from by the DNA of the animal's fecal sample. It's a messy job, but somebody's got to do it. But we kind of hope that we can identify where it came from. Maybe we don't need the color quite as badly anymore then. Maybe we can predict intake without actually having a marker, but we do add variation in things like acid rate and digestion if we don't have a marker that actually tells us this is what they eat every day. So that's a bit of a difficulty. The question is whether if we get enough fecal samples, we can correlate highly with intake without having a marker. And that's a real question in the air right now. I don't think we're there yet. The nice thing is we use this system we've got right now to validate how closely our dry lot is to our situation on the overall. We've talked a lot about things about pasture disappearance overall, and that's something that's been floated out of the industry all overall. If you have animals confined to a very small area and you have an idea from a picture, a near infrared picture or something, or some basic camera that shows grass height, before and after a group of cattle are on a paddock right now, we might get an idea of feed disappearance. The problem is you've got to do that in groups and deciding which groups of animals go together to measure the input when you're trying to get an individual animal input is very difficult. So you could put sire groups on those paddocks and another sire's progeny on another paddock and maybe get an idea of sire groups. But the design of this sort of thing is pretty difficult and there's a lot of different observations. In closing, I just want to say cow herd efficiency remains important in the U.S. market overall. We think biological efficiency is very important. Economics can change over time. And much of the focus is on the cost of maintaining the cow herd and increase the chance of increasing cows each year. That's the biological efficiency measure. The measures of income potential also continue to be important. Most of these things I've talked about are related to feed costs, so we continue to look at weight, survival, fertility, longevity, and all those measures as part of our larger germ plasm eradication program, and hopefully get some answers back to the feed costs commercial program. With that, I want to acknowledge all of these, primarily these people at US Mark in terms of efficiency, but there's many, many more. I said earlier that I've done a tremendous amount of work in this area, and can't even stand the shoes of all these people right now. The people that helped get this done right now, the other Bradford students with us right now from K-State, did a lot of this analysis on these current mature weight data. Mark Coleman, Lawrence Kelly helping co-lead the GP program. John Fields had a tremendous number of ideas in this area and developed with his talks right now. Harvey working with the cattle, and Amanda is the one working with the DNA on the fecal samples. Ron's group and his graduate students and technician at Virginia Tech formerly and now at UNL. And overall, the U.S. Mercantile Operations, Sam has helped with some of the sampling of the board at Sodium Hydrogel. So with that, I'll stop, take some questions, let anybody else add some more things that they'd like here, but overall, thank you.